coming up.
I was trying to describe something where your libido is much more enhanced if you just work out, you know, consistently. But before I could get it out, he was like, you know, a lot of times when you're in the gym and you're someone who works out often, during your session, you'd, you know, leak a bit of semen.
This is what he said. We were shocked. Hello and welcome back to Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. My name is Dr. Sir Essa, and as always, we've got a very special guest. Today, we're joined by nutrition expert and coach in the world of bodybuilding. It's Matt Waits. Let's give him a big round of applause. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, guys. I'm very happy to be considered a very special guest.
Yes. All our guests are very special. But we always love talking about fitness and health and hormones and all of those lovely things in between. So thank you for making time.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised that everyone is talking about training.
Yeah.
It's cool. So you guys are living it too.
Yeah. Look, we're not all as big as Inhlanhla, but
I was just going to say, you're definitely living it.
I'm trying. Not as much as you, but yeah, I'm trying in my free time.
So yeah, I think let's dive straight into the episode. Let's talk all things fitness, nutrition, and we'll obviously also talk about something that a lot of people find taboo, which is hormones and hormone replacement therapy, as well as performance enhancing drugs within the sport of bodybuilding. And just for the average person who may feel like they need a little bit of a boost. Matt, what are you busy with at the moment? What's your forte? I know we were talking nutrition just before the...
Yeah, so predominantly nutrition. I work for an American company by the name of ProPhysique. We are... If you look at our Instagram page, directed towards bodybuilding, competitors. Mm. But as things turn out, we have a big lifestyle following as well. And I'm coaching a wide array of people, from people that have literally never stepped foot in a gym before to pro-level bodybuilders. Yeah. And that is by design, because I think you need to work with a wide array of people with different requirements to kind of keep your skills sharp. Sometimes if all you're working with is high-level athletes, you forget what some of the challenges of the average person are.
I see.
So there's obviously the training and exercise component, but because predominantly what I'm doing is remote, I would say that is a lesser aspect. Yeah. Whereas nutrition, supplementation, in some cases, PED deployments and so on is more relevant. That being said, I still, as an online coach, I still put quite a big focus onto training. It's just very time consuming because you have to get people to send you videos of them performing their workouts, at a gym in Texas or, you know, wherever, and then review that footage. But it's still an important component. Mm-hmm. The thing, though, is that most people aren't getting it wrong with training. A lot of people enjoy training, or at least do it.
Even if
they don't enjoy it, they generally are getting stuff wrong from the nutritional side of things.
So your background, were you always, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, where are you from? How'd you get into fitness?
Okay, well, I'm from here, born in Johannesburg, and I got into fitness, as I think at least a lot of people I know did, which is I was a borderline obese teenager. And towards the end of matric, I was at a house party, a pool party. I took off my shirt. Some pretty girl made some comments about me being fat.
Good enough motivation.
One comment is all it took.
Dude. But that's the thing,
I'm telling you, most of us.
As much as I hated it at the time, that's why I am where I am now, And
but I challenge you to search that girl now and look how she looks.
Probably very true.
They always look worse. And you develop.
Wait, was it yourself? Like the cool girl back from high school?
So I didn't even know who she was. She was just at the party.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But did she look like one of those ones? Because those ones are generally the ones that fall pregnant in high school.
Yeah. The really hot ones.
She did look like one of those girls.
Okay. Got you.
So at that stage, I was ginger. I was fat. And I was like, well, I can only do something about one of those things.
Yeah.
And my cousin was a very strong athlete across a variety of different sports. And, you know, I told him about this thing and he said to me, all right, well, let's get you into the gym. And I didn't want to do it, but I forced myself to do it. Mm-hmm. And then like somewhere down the line, kind of fell in love with it. But also realized at some point that I kind of felt like I was spinning my wheels. You know, when you go in that yo-yo, get skinny, get fat, get skinny, get fat. And I was like, well, I keep oscillating between these two things and I'm not actually getting the look that I want.
Yeah.
So I did some research online and I found a coach. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
Didn't know online. You could have an online coach. Mm-hmm. And at the time, this dude was, you know, he was living in the US. I was living here. He was a bank manager at the time. But when I started working with him several years later, he became one of the biggest coaches in the industry. His name is still well known. He subsequently passed away. But he kind of got me to understand what I was actually doing and understanding the dynamics of nutrition and training and how all those pieces fit together.
Yeah.
Took me to my first two or three bodybuilding shows. Mm. And, you know, by learning to love the process,
yeah,
and then also realizing, oh, well, I can actually potentially make a living from this, that's kind of how it started.
Okay.
And I was only coaching part-time, I mean, for like 15, 16 years. Mm. So it's already only been the last 3-4 years that I've been doing it full-time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the background.
Awesome. I mean, how does it work with online coaching? Because a lot of people know about traditional, I suppose you walk into the gym and there's, as you're walking in, you'll see a whole board full of like personal trainers.
Faces,
right?
Yeah.
So most of us know, oh, you want to get somebody that's going to just help you in the gym right here for an hour a day. That's your guy. Mm-hmm. You pick your guy and he'll help you train here. Mm-hmm. And then you go home and then you got to worry about your own nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to worry about your own recovery and whatever other supplementation that you choose. But with online coaching, it seems like it's holistic. But how does it work? Like, if I wanted to join Pro Physique, what's the process and what do I have to expect?
Okay, so essentially starting point is just data gathering. So number one, what are you doing now? And what knowledge do you have?
Mm.
What are you eating? How are you training, if you're doing anything at all? And then building a starting point, and that's going to be different for different people. So some people want to function off a set meal plan. Some people want to function off tracking their own macros.
Okay.
Obviously, that's kind of what Pro Physique is about. It's about sustainability.
Just for those people who may not know what tracking your macros are.
Correct. Okay, so macros, proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. And essentially the thinking there would be, if you have those numbers prescribed to you, you can choose what foods based on your preferences you fit into your diet, making it a more sustainable approach.
Mm.
So if I give you a meal plan, I say, this is what you're eating for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. These are your snacks, and that's what you're eating every single day. Great. It's not complex, and it's easy to implement in the initial stages. But who's going to be doing that for the rest of their lives?
Exactly.
You know, what happens when you go away on vacation? Mm. You want to go out with your wife or whatever the case is?
Yeah.
You need to have some degree of flexibility, but still be able to stay on plan.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And then just a question for me with online coaching. How do you then structure sort of training plans, diet plans for someone you kind of have never seen? Like, I mean, you've never had a physical. The reason why I'm raising this is because I've also had a coach, but it was a physical, you know, we knew each other.
Yeah.
And I noticed whenever it was closer to, you know, a show that I was doing or whatever, the last couple of weeks, he wanted to see me probably every other day just to sort of see the changes. And he felt like, okay, I mean, pictures were fine. But to me, it gave me this impression that, you know, he needs to see in order to make the correct sort of changes. And I just want to know, how do you then deal with those kind of challenges? And,
From my perspective, I actually prefer operating with pictures. So even with the plethora of local clients that I coach, generally, I'll be gauging pictures first because pictures make you look worse.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, if you see somebody in their check-in pictures and you see them in person, they look better in person.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're functioning off the data which makes you look worse, then you're always going to be pushing to be better.
Do you always find that though? Because sometimes people can use lighting and the angle.
But I've literally had clients editing their check-in pictures to make themselves look better.
That's actually what I was thinking.
Which is useless, man. Bizarre. Mm. Because then what do you have a coach for?
Yes.
But just talking about like honesty and transparency between coach and clients, if you're not editing your pictures and you're doing it in the right way, I prefer operating on that and kind of assuming or seeing worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And then usually the end result is actually better and more profound than what you see in the pictures. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And the same would go with training. You ask like, how do we handle, you know, training? Mm. Well, a lot of it is going to be based on, like I said, what is the person currently doing? And then looking at footage of how they're performing those movements and programming around that, because it, to a large extent, should be individualized for whoever it is that you're coaching.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I wanted to ask about the nutrition. You described you as a nutritionist, right? A lot of people have the maybe misconception that if you want to maybe, you know, tone, build muscle, or lose weight, that you need to go to the gym and that's the most important part. Yes, you must diet, you know, but what is diet?
Mm-hmm.
And also, how important is the nutrition part of it? Let's say there's a goal I want to reach.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the gym in check. I'm not worried. I've got my program.
Mm-hmm.
What impact does the nutrition have? To say if I worked out 4 to 5 times a week, 1 to 2 hours straight focus working out, and then I have a shitty nutrition versus if I have my nutrition is on point. What will the difference be between those two people?
Okay, so I would think about it like this. Weight loss is predominantly going to be created via nutrition because it's much easier to create a caloric deficit via food. Like cutting out 500 calories from your day is much easier than burning 500 calories via exercise. Mm. So nutrition will achieve the weight loss.
Yes.
Training elicits the body composition changes. So in other words, instead of losing 10 kilograms of a combination of muscle and fat, if the training is a component, you're losing 10 kilograms of fat.
So if I want to get like Nhlanhla looks.
And coach.
Right? And he gives me his training regimen.
Mm-hmm.
And I stick to it 100%. But my diet is off, you know. Is not what it should be, because he tells us what he eats when he's preparing for sure, and it's nonsense when he's eating like cardboard, you know. But he gets the results, you know.
Yeah.
And the way I see it is that it would probably be night and day if you put two people of my physique, and you give one excellent nutrition, one shitty nutrition, but the same gym plan. I would think that the one with the awesome meal plan is going to make far bigger gains than the other one.
On paper, yes, but then there's obviously like genetic variability between individuals.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you can have guys that have terrible nutrition and look amazing because of their genetics. But yes, if genetics are equated for, then for sure nutrition is going to be a huge driver of the end result. Mm-hmm.
Would you say nutrition would be even more important than your training regime?
Well, it depends for what. So
what
like
you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, what you're trying to achieve. So like I said, working with a wide variety of clients, I can have a check-in from, you know, a morbidly obese individual that's never exercised before. And it's like, hey, listen, you just want to be healthy.
Yeah.
And just to be healthy, you probably need to lose like, you know, 30, 40 kilograms. We can definitely achieve that without exercise. And oftentimes you have to, because with those people, they're initially a little bit intimidated by going into the gym. So maybe it's just nutrition, and maybe it's increasing light activity, just getting in more steps on a daily basis.
Because they could just get injured.
Yeah.
Starting off with, you know, doing the same training regime that Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure, yes. Yeah. And then you might have somebody that is, you know, has moderate experience in the gym, and they're like, okay, I want to compete in my first bodybuilding show. Or I never want to compete, but this is the goal of what I want to look like, this type of physique, they're definitely going to have to train. So it depends on the person.
You mentioned the challenges. You're happy that you work with everyday people because it keeps you, you know, in the know with our challenges. I'm putting our.
Grounded.
Yeah. because I find that, and especially with patients that I work with, you know, because we work with weight loss even, you know, as doctors, that the nutrition part is the most difficult from a mental aspect a lot, you know. And people are addicted. The majority of our population is addicted to sugar. They just don't realize it, you know. They're addicted to salt. They just don't realize it. Have you ever taken a junior cheeseburger from McDonald's and take it apart and see the salt crystals on that thing? It's crazy, man. It's crazy. So, and a lot of it is not our fault. We are fed these things. Wherever you turn, you know, there's a McDonald's M. You know, when you switch on your TV, there's Kentucky Fried Chicken. So do you work with the cognitive aspect with your clients, you know? Or do you just give them a plan and say, you need this? How do you go navigate that difficulty?
So my background is actually in psychology. That's what I was originally intending to go into. And then I transitioned into this once I was involved in the lifestyle and I realized that this could be an actual job. But I would say, nutrition experience aside, biomechanics, et cetera, aside, all that studying that I've done, really what stood me in the greatest stead is my background in psychology. Because people think they're coming to a coach for the technical stuff, the technical knowledge. 95% of people that I will coach never need that level of detail or information. It's just about keeping them consistent on whatever their plan is. So maybe a good example is talking about like these fad diets, like carnivore, keto, paleo, et cetera, et cetera. The most effective plan is going to be that which is most sustainable for that person.
That's the word, right? Sustainable, yeah.
But it's very, very difficult to get people to buy into that because human psychology, for some reason, is very drawn to extremes. If something sounds extreme, our immediate assumption is that must work better. Not always never the case in this endeavor, ever, ever. The more extreme, the less sustainable it's going to be. So it's like, oh, you know, I can drop 10 kilograms really quickly. Like, yeah, a lot of that's not going to be body fat. A lot of that's going to be muscle and just other lean tissue. And was it really successful? I have so many clients that come speak to me and go, oh, yes, the previous diet that I did, I lost 40 pounds and it worked really well. And I always say to them, no, it didn't, because you're here now. If it worked well, why are you speaking to me?
Exactly.
Because you weren't able to sustain it. It works well. It was a success if you get there and you can keep it off. So communicating that is probably like the first step, and then keeping them focused on the end goal is very important. And often that comes down to what is the underlying reason why they're doing it? I already told you mine. I was embarrassed at a house party in front of all of my friends and in front of all these other girls when I was, you know, 17 years old. That's a good motivating factor. Wanting to have a six pack is not a good motivating factor. So what is their why? It's not just to look better. There's something behind that. There's something that's motivating them to do it. Whether it be, you know, a middle-aged guy that's like, dude, I'm really unhealthy. I have young kids and I don't think that I'm going to see them grow up if I carry on going this way. Or it could be a young guy that's embarrassed to take his shirt off at the beach.
Exactly.
You know?
Sorry, sorry to cut you. But I just think I should share the story with you. We actually see a lot of patients, young guys. And most of the motivation they get just to see us, just to consult a doctor and get help, is actually sexual dysfunction. So erectile dysfunction. And I'm just picking that up because there's always this underlying problem. That's not really what they paint, you know.
Yes.
Like someone will book a general consult and they act like, you know, they'll tell you a long story about basically nothing.
Yeah.
And when they're telling that story, you realize, you know, how the girlfriend is so important to them.
Yes.
And how this girlfriend is all of a sudden not happy, or the wife is not happy. And, you know, he's just taking it upon himself to say, you know, maybe it's because I'm coming too fast, or maybe because of this, or you understand? Yeah. So yeah, it's just interesting how you know, you look at it. And actually, I think it's the psychology as well that you have an interest in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it takes a lot to reach out to a coach. It's like, because you have to fill in this whole data form, you know, you have to essentially submit pictures of yourself in your underwear. Mm. So when I'm getting that, I'm going, there is a motivation behind this. And it's not just, I want to look better. There's something deeper than that. And if you can get to what's deeper than that, that's when you can really hold people accountable. Because when shit gets hard, because it will, it will. The biggest mistake that people make when they go into this, the greatest ingredient of failure is thinking it's going to be easy. Mm. Come into it and know that it's going to be hard, so that when the hard times hit, you expect it and you can go and you can get through them. But when you can get to that root cause, what is the thing that made you reach out to me? When the hard times hit, you can remind them of that, and that will keep them going.
Mm.
Cool, great stuff. And then how do you deal with clients, especially young, I wouldn't consider immature, but like just, you know, fitness sort of naive clients. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get those young 18-year-olds or 19-year-old who was also embarrassed. You know, he's been training for a couple of months and he just feels like nothing is happening. So he heard, you know, a friend saying, you know, I take Enova, I take Tren, I take Winstrol and all these things. And they obviously don't know what it is, where they can get it. And I mean, I can just go to someone online who doesn't know me, can't see me. I'm just thinking it's so attractive to come to someone like you, to them. How do you deal with those kind of problems?
Dude, it's such a double-edged sword. And we were just talking about it earlier. It's kind of like the narrative around abstinence from sex as a means of birth control. Mm. It's like you can preach it and be like, it's the only 100% effective method. It's like, yeah, but teenagers just aren't going to stay abstinent. Mm. It's like when you have a 19-year-old kid that wants to use gear, there's a really good chance they're going to do it anyway and just do it in the most misinformed possible manner, as I did when I was a 19-year-old kid and completely screwed myself up. Mm. So saying don't talk about it or don't advise them, it doesn't work. Mm. So the best thing that you can possibly do is just give the facts. Mm. You're like, this is because there is no safe way to do it. Mm. There is safer ways to do it, but it doesn't mitigate all risk. That is the reality. Mm. So you have to lay it all out for them and say, this is a way to do it. This is what you can expect to spend if you want to do it safely. Mm. Lab work every 3 months, you know, compound selection, which if you're doing it right, is going to be a lot more expensive. Yeah. Getting it from reliable sources where the stuff isn't counterfeit, and then you're running a whole bunch of other risk aside from that. Mm. And, you know, educating them on the variety of health issues that they could run into, you know. Yeah. I mean, the amounts of guys that I know now that were blasting gear for years when they were, you know, teenagers and early 20s, that don't even train anymore and now have so much health dysfunction that they've just essentially ruined their adult lives. But at the same time, if you don't speak about it, that's the route that people are going to go. So you have to educate them, and that's why I'm appreciative that there are doctors like you in existence nowadays.
That wasn't
the case 6-7 years ago. You couldn't refer somebody to a doctor and say, listen, go to this physician, get your lab work done, inform them what they're using, and you can get you know, expert advice on your health markers and what you should be doing if everything's sitting in a good position. You know, 6-7 years ago, you would essentially get chastised by your doctor.
I mean, even now, you probably still get the same kind of attitude. I mean, most of our colleagues probably think, what the hell? Why are we giving patients testosterone replacement therapy? I think if that's probably, this is actually the reason why we even started this company.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've always been fit guys. I mean, varsity, you know, we were just all those guys after a long day of lectures, we all meet in the gym and push some weights, you know. And I mean, we'd hear these questions. We know about gear, you know, yeah. we know. But and we have people asking us these questions because we're doctors, yeah. expecting that you probably know a lot. Mm-hmm. You know a lot about.
You know more than us.
Yeah. yeah. And I mean, to be honest, the biggest reason why doctors won't address these problems is because we don't know a lot. We don't know much. And I mean, there isn't much
not,
on it.
Yeah. And there isn't also, much it's not studied. Well taught. Mm. And with regards to like the taboo, what I find very interesting is, if you look at the irony of the medical fraternity, you're allowed as a practitioner, if you get referred a woman who says, I want you to do a termination of pregnancy, mm-hmm. and it's against your morals, you mm-hmm. can say, no, I'll just refer them. But if somebody comes to you with like, hey, here's my bag of steroids, this is what I'm going to do. You almost feel like this is worse than that.
yeah, dude.
This is 100%. Way worse. Like, I can't tell you what to do here. I'm not allowed to. I can't even do research. And we're not taught at all. We understand what testosterone does, mm-hmm. but we don't understand those specific compounds that people are using for, you know, the DHT predominant ones over just pure, short-acting testosterone.
DHT derivatives and 19-ols.
Yeah. So all of these kind of compounds that people are using, we've had to basically self-study.
Mm. Yes.
And inform ourselves so that we can give them proper advice, mm-hmm. which now I think we're moving into the next generation where a lot more people in the fitness industry are open about it. They are talking about it. Whereas if you go back to like the 90s, they were like, oh, you just eat your chicken and broccoli.
Yeah.
And you'll walk around at 120 kilos.
Well, there's still guys that are doing that.
Which is like bizarre to me because it's like we understand that this sport has evolved to a point where we want to see almost like Greek god statue like figures. You cannot get that naturally. It's just impossible. It's impossible to get that. You can get something very close. I'm sure that there's genetic outliers who can get really, really great physiques with the best training regimen, best nutrition. There's still a ceiling. That you will hit.
There's still a ceiling, for sure.
And you will not break that unless you're willing to do more than just train and eat healthy.
Yeah. And I mean, the way that PEDs are looked at now is kind of, I remember being in, you know, early high school and you get, you know, these anti-drug lectures coming in. Mm. And they preach about, let's say, all drugs being created equal, like, weed's a gateway and, you know, it's just as bad as heroin. And then you realize that that's not the case.
Yeah.
And it's very similar with PED deployment now where they classify that in one box, like it's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, while you can't negate all risk, you can reduce it.
Yeah.
But the only way you can do that and you expose that to people is to speak about it and to have people that are knowledgeable about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
No, that's true. And going to that, there are compounds that obviously through self-studying, like he said, that's how we built up this company, is basically like in the nights, you know, we're sitting under the lamps and like, guys, a 19 knows and all that, you know. That's how we're doing it. But there are certain things that, like, if my brother came to me, I'd say to him, listen, use this and this, but stay away from that. Don't use that at all. So what you're saying about, you know, that we demonize everything isn't the way that we should actually be going with this, you know. I wanted to follow up with that. We see on social media a lot of American influencers or even just kids who are not even influencers already using these compounds, Tren and so forth. Do you find that South African kids now are also, you know, using it more and more often or requesting it?
Man, at this point, I very, very rarely take on any local clients unless they're already very high level athletes.
Okay.
But I get the applications all the time. And on my intake form, one of the last questions I ask is like current or previous PD usage. And A, really, really young guys. And B, guys that look like they don't train are blasting more gear and using heavier compounds than I ever have. I've competed. I'm 38 now. I've competed since I was 21. So 17 years. I won my pro card last year. And they're using more than I ever have.
I think
you can ask them, have you ever had your blood work done? No.
I mean, I've had patients. I had a guy who was literally never done a post-cycle therapy for 10 years. Came to us, could not get any erection, had gynecomastia. Mm-hmm. He was like on the verge of like, he was depressed, couldn't please his girlfriend. Oh, but he looks okay.
But I mean, like, he's got big nipples, but he's like,
he's got a six pack.
He does.
Every now and then a drop of milk comes out.
You know what I mean? And I'm telling him, I was like, you know, in these consultations, he eventually just left our clinic completely. And no matter how hard I tried to get him back, I think we fixed him. I gave him the treatment.
Yeah.
I got his access back up, and he's probably blasting himself into infinity again.
Into oblivion.
Because I think that a lot of people believe this. They believe that it's going to make you superhuman, and nothing can ever go wrong.
Mm.
And two, you also get this addiction to it. From what a lot of these clients talk about. I mean, I had not even in our private clinic, I had a guy in the casualty, I work in the emergency unit. So I had a guy who came in with full-blown kidney failure.
Mm.
Yeah.
Bodyguard. Guy that just, he's a bodyguard, and he's like, I needed to use gear to look the part, otherwise I was going to lose my job.
Yeah.
So he blasted like the most crazy, he was using everything.
Yeah.
Like when I say he was using growth hormones and he was using anabolics and he was using the newer MK677s and all these stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like peptides and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Peptides and everything. Kidneys are failing. Oh. He's got gynecomastia. He's got all of this. And he was just like, I couldn't stop. It's just the feeling.
Why is he in casualty?
Oh, because his kidney failure. Now he's completely fluid overloaded.
Oh, yeah,
he's messed himself up.
It's not a mental addiction. It's addiction to the look and the feeling, not specifically like drugs.
Like the drug itself.
Like cocaine.
Yeah. It's definitely not a physical addiction. It's not like, oh my God, I need to.
I think to some extent, like when they describe the feeling of when you first starting, it feels like, I mean, your libido goes up, your strength goes up, all of those types of things.
Certainly the feeling in the gym, like the performance that you get, for sure. But I mean, I can't recall myself or any client really. I think usually the narrative I hear is I was expecting to feel something.
Mm.
Like you hear about this, it's like this big deal.
Mm.
And then you take it and you're expecting to feel something and you just don't really.
Mm.
I mean, obviously increase libido and increase strength, but just like day to day, you kind of function the same, you know? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's obviously the look.
From a mental point of view, you're saying feeling is not different.
Like coming off and then you know, you're going into the gym and everything's just kind of staying static. You're not just, you know, moving up in terms of the loads and the lifts every week. And, you know, you get a little bit softer, you get a little bit smaller. Yeah, you know, you miss that look.
Yeah.
What I've also realized, you know, through reading this and watching guys on YouTube is that there's also a ceiling once you've started gear as well. It might get you past your natural ceiling, but then there's also a ceiling, and there's a point where you can use as much as you want, but you're not going to. I've seen lots of guys. There was a famous guy that actually passed away, Boston Lloyd. I don't know if you knew about him.
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy was using everything under the sun.
He was almost purposefully doing that, almost like using himself as a like personal
guinea
lab
pig,
rat.
It's
weird.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's another thing to note as well. You know, I'm just saying it for people out there that, you know, when we say, like when you said there's a guy who's used way more than you ever have, you know why you used what you used, you know, because you want to achieve what you want to achieve, and you know that going beyond this has nothing. I mean, look, when you got your pro card now a few months ago, right?
Yeah.
And if you had used like everything under the sun 10 years ago, you still wouldn't necessarily have got your pro card back then.
100%. I think there's as much as there is genetics of a natural athlete, reaching a certain ceiling, there also seems to be a genetic response to androgen usage.
Mm.
So maybe it's like the number of androgen receptors you have in your muscle cells or something like that. Mm. But you can look at, let's say, for example, a natural Chris Bumstead,
mm-hmm.
who was incredible naturally and then also had a profound response to androgens.
Yeah.
And then you look at somebody like Nick Walker, mm-hmm. who was almost like an average or below average natural,
mm-hmm.
but then had this
massive explosion,
insane response when he became enhanced. Mm. And a lot of people just don't have that. And they can use higher dosages and harsher compounds, and they still don't get the same response that somebody else does off 200 milligrams of testosterone.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I actually wanted to say something to Matthews about this, the second ceiling. I've actually never heard that. I've always had the idea that obviously once you've passed that natural ceiling, then
the sky is literally
the limit. And the reason why I say that is because I'm coming from a perspective of someone who's being guided, someone who's, you know, who actually knows what they're doing. They have their diet on point, their training is fine. Not someone who's just being a lab rat and trying and injecting everything they can find. I think, you know, with performance-enhancing drugs, you can get to really, really, really phenomenal physique.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's just my take, yeah.
Let's pull it back a bit, because I know everybody loves talking about PEDs, but let's go back a bit to the nutrition. So you were talking off camera about the currently nutritionists and coaching in this country, and that there's no certification, or no certification is not a requirement to be a coach necessarily. And what problems that does that pose?
Well, so I think globally, to call yourself a coach, you don't require a certification or any kind of education. But internationally, generally, people are seeking out coaches that are well-known or associated with teams that are well-known.
Mm-hmm.
So with ProPhysique or J3U or any of, you know, other well-known teams, they will only accept somebody as a coach if there is they have a certain background and a certain education. In South Africa, and I would say probably because there is a lesser percentage of the population that have the kind of expendable income that they can spend on it is really a luxury.
Mm.
Often people go with the cheapest option, which are individuals that have gone through their own body transformation or maybe have competed in a bodybuilding show, done reasonably well. It's like, okay, now I'm a coach.
Mm.
And then there's an approach where it's like, okay, well, my coach did this for me to get me from this point to this point, and then I'm just going to do that to every person that comes to me, thinking that it's the same process, which it's not. And then it also creates issues because if you don't know what you don't know, so you don't know where you're missing gaps in knowledge. Whereas if you understand what your scope of practice is, and you guys just mentioned it now, you're like, well, as doctors, this is our scope of practice. We are not educated in this, so we've had to self-study.
Mm.
As a nutrition coach that has studied, you also understand, I am not a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, when I have clients on PEDs or, you know, dude, clients come to you with weird things. You're their coach. You're there to get them leaner or to add muscle, whatever the case is, but they ask you medical questions. If you don't have the knowledge and the background and the experience and the education to go, this is not my wheelhouse, I have to refer you to a doctor, then you're operating in a space where these people think that they can solve everything. And that causes a lot more issues for clients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would like to operate in an area where people like me and people like you can work together, and you understand what's your wheelhouse, I understand what's my wheelhouse, and we can work together for the best outcome of the individual.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think, you know, nutrition, because we were talking about the ceilings, right? So obviously if somebody who's never trained a day in their life and just looks at a pro bodybuilder and goes, yeah, if I just inject myself once every week, I'm going to look like that,
mm-hmm.
versus the guy that's naturally enhanced himself. So with his training regime, with his diet, he is far more likely that if he does end up going and down the path of PED use, that his his ceiling will be reached at a far later stage. Or at least that's my understanding.
I think so. I mean, I'm not fully aware if there's... See, this is a thing about PEDs is that it's hard to really study them. Now, a lot of the studies that we have are like, you know, from years and years ago. But I would contend that for an athlete, the longer you stay natural and the more you push that natural ceiling, the better the results, the longer they will last, the more profound they will be if and when you do introduce PEDs.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay. And now I'm just talking specifically about your coaching. So when you come up with a plan, what are the things that you specifically look at? Obviously, let's say everybody wants to look like Nhlanhla. Wants to have a good muscle tone, muscle mass, and low body fat. But the majority of people, I'm assuming, that's what they want. Yes, the others just want to be healthy, want to get fitter, improve their cardiovascular health, sure. But for the majority of people who are going down the path of, I want somebody to make me look better.
Yeah.
Make me look better, make me feel better simultaneously. What are the things that you kind of look at? Do you look at, oh, is this person an endomorph, mesomorph, ectomorph? Do you use the BMI? Like, what are kind of the methods? Or am I giving away your business too much?
No.
Now you're going to get fake coaches popping up.
Not at all. Well, you see, that's the thing, is that initial assessment and then implementation of a plan, people are very focused on that. Now, a lot of that is kind of just estimates from formulas of going, okay, so this person is this age, this gender, this weight, roughly this body composition, a certain activity level. Let's start them out at this caloric intake, this macronutrient level. But those are estimates. Really, the magic in the process is when you get somebody to implement a plan, whatever it may be, then you gauge the feedback. Then you can make the relevant adjustments for that person.
Yes.
Because you might have two identical people, age, weight, activity level, body composition, give them the exact same plan that is implemented in the exact same way, and they might respond differently. So you have to base that plan on the individual, but the only way you can do that is getting them to implement that initial plan and gauging the results.
I see. But so you don't just give like a blanket plan to everyone and say, okay, try this and then let's see what happens. Yeah. Or do you go, I think you're a skinny guy, you want to bulk up. Let me give you more calories, let me make you lift a bit heavier, less reps. Is that how you kind
of... Well, of course, I speak to everyone beforehand. So there'll be the intake form that'll be filled out, and then I'll usually do a Zoom consultation with them where we're running through, you know, give me your history in terms of training. Give me your history in terms of nutrition. What have you done before? What has worked in the past? And, you know, what are some short, medium, and long-term goals that you want to achieve? So the goal will be based on that. The timeline will be based on that. But the implementation of the plan, exact nutritional context, training parameters will be, like I said, based off estimates, based on formulas of where they should respond. But oftentimes that's not the case. So you have to gauge what the response is and then change the plan accordingly.
I see. The one thing we didn't talk about of the three aspects, because I know we need to wrap up shortly, but the one thing that we didn't really touch on is like, what are your training theories? Off camera, I know we asked you about our favorite Mike Mensa. Dr. Sharif there, who's not joining us today. He asked about specifically Mike Mensa, the theory that all you need is enough stimulus to the muscle, as long as it's high enough intensity that you stress the muscle enough to break it down and get enough calories and sleep and recovery so that it can regenerate.
Okay, well, I hope I don't butcher this analogy, because I think I heard it from Dr. Mike Isretel. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar
I've
with
seen,
him. Yeah,
I've seen some of his stuff.
So, and I think it's relevant because you guys are doctors. So the intensity versus volume debate isn't really a debate, because it's kind of like a medication and the dosage. Both of those things are important. If you're taking the wrong medication, it's a problem. If you're taking a dosage that is too small or too high, it's also a problem. So intensity is kind of like the medication, volume is the dosage. So there's a right amount of both.
Okay.
And again, there's going to be individual variability. Mm-hmm. So somebody like Mike Mensa, and this is the working theory now, is that the more advanced you get, and I'm sure you've heard of like the idea of mind-muscle connection.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With a better mind-muscle connection and more kind of high threshold motor units, per rep, per set, you are able to elicit a much greater stimulus. Mm-hmm. Okay. Therefore, you would probably need lower volume. Whereas the less experience you have, the shorter period of time that you've been training, you might need more volume because the stimulus per rep and per set is a little bit less.
Yeah.
So, and Dr. Mike also speaks about this, is like minimum effective volume, kind of middle of the road, and then maximum recoverable volume. Those again are estimates, but they are workable targets for people to aim for. But my opinion is that intensity is like the bread and butter of what you're doing. If you can do all the volume in the world, if you're not training hard enough, you're not going to get a response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for most people, if you just had to do one all-out set of squats every week, you're also probably not going to get a response.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is something that you guys didn't point out to him. So the reason why I think Dr. Nassim is so obsessed with Mike Mensa's training plan is because he gets to go to gym once a week or something like once or twice a week.
Yeah.
You know, this guy says do twice a week, you get all the results you want.
Yeah.
All you need to do is just overload.
You can just
go progressively and you're fine.
Week.
You just hold the weight in one place. And then you have little, which is I think you actually highlighted it very nicely by saying that, these things do work, but you need to understand that there's people for all these training intensities. Mm-hmm. And there's other factors like mind mind what connection?
Mind muscle connection.
Yeah. Mm. And some of the things that guys like that, especially pro guys, they also forget where they started. It's very easy to sit in a place of, power and big guns and give advice and forget that, when you started, when I started, I used to also train with guys who trained 3 hours and you would just push and push and push and push. And I mean, that worked at that time because I was starting off, I didn't know about mind muscle connection.
It takes you to push.
No, the thing is, you also learn with time. The fact that, the last 3 months, because of my schedule, I've only had 30 minutes to train in the gym. And I look freaking amazing. And there was a time where, I would go to gym even twice a day. You go in the morning, you do like a quick cardio session. And then some evenings, maybe twice, 3 times a week, I'd go in and push some weight. And I look crap, And then you're like, wait, this doesn't make sense.
So there
actually is a huge component of what
and
are you actually
also
doing?
Probably also recovery. Probably if you're training twice a day and you're not getting enough good recovery.
Mm.
Exactly. And like people always like, the question is, does this work? It's like, it's the wrong question. Mm. It's like, especially for beginners or intermediates, everything's going to work to a certain extent. The question should rather be, is this the best approach or will this work optimally?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is, unfortunately, I can't tell you because there is a big individual variance. Somebody like Mike Mensa or Dorian Yates, that worked really well for them. For somebody like Dexter Jackson, he was like really high volume
and ripped as fuck.
They both got the results.
Mm. Mm.
So you have to kind of try different approaches and see what is best for you and how you respond best. But also,
and
never ever
like,
look at a pro bodybuilder and be like, he's doing that, so that's what I'm going to do. Every top level pro bodybuilder is by definition a fucking genetic outlier.
Yeah,
so never look at that. Yeah. My first coach, John Meadows, said to me, he was like, never look at the guy in the gym with the biggest biceps and ask him what he does for his biceps. Mm. Look at the guy that had the worst biceps that grew them a little bit. Ask him what he did.
Mm. Ah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And would you, okay, I know we're still talking about training. Just a wrap up.
One
and then Brendan can ask his question.
Yeah,
do you think that like certain muscles respond better with volume and other muscles don't? Like, do you think like, for example, your legs need more volume, but your arms need just more intensity and less reps? Like,
for sure. And I think that has to do with distribution of different muscle fibers.
Mm.
So like, for example, calves. because you're walking around all day and you're kind of always using them, they recover super quick and they respond to higher volume and higher frequency. Whereas, let's say maybe, I don't know, chest or whatever the case may be, tends to respond to slightly lower volume. But I don't necessarily have data that I can point to say, this study says that. Plus, you can find studies that say both both things in a fairly new industry, but that is typically what I've picked up.
Mm.
Shoulders, calves, abdominals definitely respond to higher volume and higher frequency, and broadly speaking, other muscle groups are kind of a balance between the two.
Yeah, I see.
We had a few weeks ago. We had another bodybuilder, South African guy. Maybe you know him. But
I do know him. Yes,
Offense.
It's a small industry. Right?
Yeah,
everyone knows everyone.
And I was trying to describe something where your libido is much more enhanced if you just work out, you know, consistently. But before I could get it out, he was like, you know, a lot of times when you're in the gym and you're someone who works out often, during your session, you'd, you know, leak a bit of semen.
This is what he said. We were shocked. We were like, I don't know. Yeah.
No. But wasn't he speaking about, because he's a personal trainer, I know. So wasn't he talking about ladies that he trains?
No, he was talking about himself.
Wait, since that, I've collected quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that this actually happens to ladies in the gym.
Ladies or men?
They just leak. I don't know what they're leaking, but they're leaking something. So I just wanted to confirm with you as a pro and as a nutritionist.
I'm leak-free, to be honest. And I've also I've heard a lot of shit in a long career of coaching. I've never heard that.
Yeah. I was shocked.
But
I interpreted that was the fact that basically what he was saying is that, especially with ladies, and you know how they're always focusing on their bums and their lower leg, that for some odd reason in some ladies, they actually get like a sort of a sexual arousal from certain exercises, like
squatting. Call it corgasm.
Oh, I have heard that. Yes.
Corgasm. And that's what I heard. I mean,
and
that's
some,
what I think he was saying.
And then it get wet, and then it
would
leak.
I have heard of that.
Yeah. Like hip thrusts and all that.
Yes. Yeah.
But not men
but
leaking
not,
semen.
No,
that I've not
way,
heard of.
No way.
That's just from an intense session.
But I believe Offense, why he had no reason to lie. Why would he?
But did you also say that, you know, with drop, sexually transmitted infection, you can get stuff?
I asked, is it drop? You see, it's not drop. So in your experience.
It was not a question I was expecting.
Okay, forget the leaking, but would you say like an increase in libido? Would you say just from training?
Just from training, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Across the board, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For sure.
No, that's great.
But no leaking.
Just to be clear, all of us are leak free here.
I'm leak free.
In case you guys are wondering.
No.
Before we wrap up, we've got a quick clip that we want to play, and we'll just discuss this quickly, just to hear everyone's thoughts. Let's play the clip.
Bing tells us she was just trying to get to a Detroit Lions watch party this month when her Lyft rolled up.
As I'm walking, I see him like making faces or whatever. I'm like, oh man.
She already knew.
I can fit in this car.
No, believe me, you can.
Yes, I can.
Believe me.
He told her there's not enough room in his car.
The kicker part was when he started to talk about his tires. You know, I feel like that was a slap in the face. That was like my tires, you know, like.
The driver said his tires could not handle her weight.
So every big person you turn down because they can't fit in your car?
Yeah, because they need to order the Uber XL.
No, I don't never have to order an Uber XL.
He apologized, canceled the ride, and left her there.
Okay.
Colored guys have
been doing it's so cool that you just played this. My wife and I were talking about it this morning.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Just a specific clip. So what was your discussion like? What did you...
So I didn't see the clip. My wife was just telling me about it. And I said, well, that sounds fairly legitimate because... Maybe it's like a Hyundai i10. Like how big is this woman?
Yeah.
How small is the car?
Mm.
So I don't know how big the car was, But
yeah, it looks like a Corolla, but yeah, you can't see, and it's, it looks
but,
like.
But I'm sure Uber drivers also have rights. I mean, if he's, yeah, look, it's his car. I mean, if
I mean,
something really
didn't
happens,
even. I think he was being reasonable in saying like, hey, there are options. You know, there's guys. This you is, can't, because you know Uber Go. You know you can get Uber Go, Uber X, Uber cars. XL.
So that
Uber
is my
Black.
Point. Is like if this is an Uber Go,
yeah,
she probably can't fit in there.
Mm.
But if it's a, if it's just a normal size sedan, and yeah, also your tires can handle it. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, okay. No, the tires. I feel like you didn't need to say that.
You guys, colored guys have been doing this like since I was growing up. Have you never seen?
Huh?
This is a normal thing, man.
Like what?
When you're fat,
you know, colored bras are always, we're always driving Golfs, right?
Yeah, but they drop the suspension.
And it's VW. Have you all never seen a sticker at the back of the Golf that says "No fat chicks, double rub"?
Oh wow!
Have you never seen that?
You see, so my wife is colored, and that's probably why she married a white guy.
But I swear, next time look at. If you in any Kasi Joe, look at the Golfs, I'm sure you'll see a sticker.
I have seen
that. Fat chicks, double rub. You've seen that.
Double rub.
Double rub.
I have seen that.
Well, he's Mexican, so it's close enough.
But coming back to that, I would want to see exactly what car that was, because that will be the determining factor whether he was being an asshole or whether he was justified. Yeah.
Mm.
No, but about 2 years ago, I saw, you guys know Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
He had this whole movement now in the world of like fat positivity and
yeah, body
and so
positivity,
forth.
Yeah.
And there's this these people who are like
fat positivity. No, but that's basically what it is.
From the way that you said it, I know what you think about that movement.
We know exactly what
they were busy complaining and saying that airlines need to be told that they need to make chairs specifically for fat people.
Mm.
That was the whole move. Their whole movement was that taxis, airplanes, Boeing and Airbus must make planes with seats designated for overweight or fat people.
I mean, that, like from a if you just have to look at it from a business point of view, that makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're a business that's just starting off, now you have to accommodate. I mean, think about even if you look, all of us have been on a plane. Right,
you know,
been on a plane.
Maybe say to pay for two people.
Yeah,
pay double.
Yeah, no, pay
like
double.
That's how unfair. Like you encroaching on somebody else's space, only based purely on the width that you possess. I mean, there's no other way to say it.
Guys, but sorry like, for laughing like this, but
you encroaching on somebody else's. They paid for a seat. Now, like I was on a flight recently, and the guy next to me was morbidly obese. And the whole flight, like his thigh was on my seat.
And falling on your side.
And like the snoring. And I was just like, okay, so we say body positivity, but clearly there's a problem. The body's not supposed to breathe like that.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like if your fridge makes a sound, you go and get someone to fix it.
Yes. Yes.
But we're not going to say, oh, we appreciate the fridge the way it is.
I was saying what's weird is the concept that the world must adapt for you. Because one of my best friends is a very, very large Afrikaans guy. And by large, I mean not just muscular, but tall. He's like 6'9", 6'10", and massive.
Mm.
And he always says he doesn't get like that movement because nobody fits in with him. There's certain cars that he can't fit into. He can't get shoes that fit him. He can't get pants that fit him. He has to order specially from overseas. It's like you have to fit in with the average, the general population.
Normal.
Yes. Yeah. So
I suppose in America that is becoming normal. Like that size is what is normal.
That's true.
And and the reason why that's becoming normal is because, you know, big companies want to push sugar into every drink that people have, and this idea that you eating a meal that you can get in 5 minutes is better than cooking something yourself. And now we're feeding into that by going, that body that they sold to us, that's the one that's the best thing for us.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems like this whole big capitalist ploy. Let's feed them more, pump them more, and then tell them that that's the right size to be at. Because it makes them more money. Doesn't make you healthier. Doesn't make you any better.
And body positivity is a really weird way to put it, because if I hear that term, I like that term. Mm. Because not everyone is going to look like a supermodel or a pro bodybuilder. Mm. So when I hear that, I interpret it as do the best that you can and compare yourself against yourself. Mm. Don't be comparing yourself against Ronnie Coleman or whatever the case is.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't take it to mean be as obese and unhealthy as you can possibly be and expect people to appreciate it.
Mm.
But I guess another big thing that we shouldn't overlook when we're talking about these cases is the fact that, you know, not everyone actually has control over these. Because, I mean, that's literally the underlying sort of thing that we're not really addressing. The fact that people who are obese, you know, we tend to assume it's sort of like a lifestyle that they live. You know, but some people, yes, there is a lifestyle element to it. But, I mean, countless times on this show, we've discussed about, you know, patients who actually have hormonal issues. Mm. They have genetic predispositions to being, you know, large and, you know, and retaining as much. I mean, they're probably eating as much as you. They're on a diet.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But, you know, their body tends to just convert whatever carbs, whatever they have into fat. And it's just, you know, it's something they... Yeah. No, they're struggling. It's a condition.
That's very true. That's an important point. Obviously, I'm sure we were all talking about people who have just blown themselves up from their lifestyle and not caring and like, well, yeah, I'm going to eat this whole chocolate cake and don't tell me. I think that's who we're talking about. You're not talking about those people who have serious medical conditions. But I think it's important that you bring that up too, because there might be people who have medical conditions and now they just follow that movement and they don't know that I have a problem. So because they really feel so ridiculed out in the world, they're like, let me join this movement, you know, and be part of this because I am this person who I am and I can't fix it. So they don't understand. And you mentioning it, of course, should wake people up and make them realize that, hey, let me go and see if there's a problem, you know, with my why I'm gaining weight.
Especially when you're doing things right, you know, especially, I mean, I've heard, how many times have you heard an obese person saying, you know, I am in a diet or some type of diet.
I work out.
You know, I do pay attention to my weight. I weigh myself.
And then, even in our cases, we've had guys who have come to us and like, I've been training for so long. Nothing has changed. I really want to improve myself. Do their blood testosterone levels on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Change the testosterone. Suddenly now the guy is, his diet, same diet, same training regimen, but he looks 10 times better.
That for sure happens. Yeah. It for sure happens.
So, I mean, just, I think... when people watch this, it's not that we're saying body positivity as a movement is all wrong. I think it's that we must look at that specific statement, body positivity. We want you to be healthy within your frame.
That's it. It's like there should be different standards of attractiveness or what is desirable, what you want for yourself. Yeah. But it's the waters start getting muddy when that is significantly affecting your health and your longevity.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So, I mean, if anyone's watching this that's ready to change their life, whether it be you're concerned that you've been dieting and exercising for years and you just aren't achieving your goals, maybe it's a hormonal problem. Maybe it's something in your diet. You could be, for example, gluten intolerant and you may be eating the right macros or getting enough carbohydrates in your system.
Maybe absorbing
them. But if it's
them.
Predominantly gluten-based, you're going to hold a lot more water, you're going to feel a lot more bloated. So there's a lot of different aspects that I think people need to consider consulting with experts such as all of us here in order to get to their optimal state of health. Yeah. And so thank you, Matt, for,
thanks for
coming on.
This was fun.
We definitely should have you back on here again. I think there are a few people, a few guests that we actually should invite on the podcast so that you can give them direct advice.
Exactly. Yeah.
You don't put me on the spot like that. Well, that's what I'm all about. I'm down for that.
Where can people find you? Or
you say
you work with the States, eh?
Not only. It's just because the company is based in the States.
Okay.
I still work with locals. I work with people all around the world. Mm-hmm. But I'll drop you guys my Instagram handle, my email address.
Oh, you can say it. Yes, well.
Yeah, yeah.
Say okay, so Instagram at coach_Matt_weights_. Yeah.
Okay.
And then my email address is matt@prophysique.com.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt. We really appreciate your time.
Nice to meet you guys.
That's been another great episode, chatting all things health and fitness. My name is Sohail Essa, signing off.
Dr. Vilagazi.
Brendan Matthews.
Matt. Dr. Matt Wakes. No. Coach Matt.
Coach Matt.
We'll catch you guys next week. Cheers.